This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Hey, this is Christina Quinn. I'm the host of Try This, the Washington Post's new series of audio courses. The idea behind Try This is to become better functioning humans without having to comb the internet for countless hours. In our first course, we learned how to sleep better. Now, we're going to learn how to make our friendships stronger. I'll offer expert tips that are doable, and I'll keep it short. So let's do this. Class is in session. Find Try This from the Washington Post wherever you listen.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Welcome to the Daily Dive Weekend Edition. I'm Oscar Ramirez, and every week I explore the top stories making waves in the news and some that are just plain interesting. I'll connect you with the journalists and the people who know the story and bring you news without the noise so you can make an informed decision. You can catch a new episode of The Daily Dive every Monday through Friday, and it's ready when you wake up. On the Weekend Edition, I'll be bringing you some of the best stories from the week. Big political news this week. President Biden and Vladimir Putin had their much-anticipated summit on Wednesday, and both walked away saying that the meeting was positive and constructive. President Biden said he pressed Putin on recent cyber attacks and human rights issues. They did agree on their ambassadors to return to their posts, begin strategic stability talks on nuclear arms, and consultations on cybersecurity issues. For more of the big takeaways, we'll speak to Nihal Tusi, foreign affairs correspondent at Politico.
The gist of it was that they kind of agreed to keep talking. And given that the Russian-U.S. relationship is in such a bad situation and on a downward trajectory, simply the fact that they, first of all, talked and agreed to keep talking on certain things is considered something of a win. In terms of what emerged, I would say two things. One was this agreement to continue discussions on what they use the term strategic stability. That usually refers to like nuclear arms issues. So there's going to be continued discussions on that. And that's a good thing for people who want the Earth to continue to exist, I guess.
Right.
And then the other thing was, you know, that Biden said he made it very clear to Putin that there have to be some limits on these cyber attacks, especially when it comes to critical infrastructure like water systems, that sort of thing. And he made it sound like he, you know, got that across to Putin and that he hopes that at some point down the line, there can be some sort of a cybersecurity arrangement of sorts that, you know, deals with this particular issue. And to be clear, it often involves criminals that don't have anything to do with the Kremlin. You know, it's more about making sure that Russia will hold people accountable for those types of activities, even if it's not directed by the Kremlin. And obviously, you know, we don't want the Kremlin to carry out those activities. And I think the U.S., Biden made it very clear that, as he put it, like the U.S. has some serious cyber capabilities. Would you like it if we do that to you? So those are, I would say, two things. And then they're going to talk about a bunch of other stuff from Afghanistan to Syria to whatever. But he himself, Biden, admitted that it would be months before we knew if anything seriously concrete was going to result from that.
President Biden gave Putin a list of 16 entities that were critical to U.S. infrastructure that he said should be off limits. And Putin, for his part, did say you know, we want to start some consultations on the cybersecurity issue. Not necessarily something that President Biden said, but it did seem like, I guess, the message came across, but he never accepted responsibility for it anyway. I mean, he believed that they should be faulted for some of these cyber attacks that were going through.
Yeah, in fact, Putin claimed without any evidence that most cyber attacks come from the United States, and that this is where all the criminals are based. I mean, look, it's, you know, he is never going to stand out there and say, oh, yeah, we did something wrong or we're responsible. I mean, that is just not how Vladimir Putin stays in power. That is not how he controls the narrative for his own domestic constituency. But, you know, that's just it. But that doesn't mean that they won't work on certain fronts, especially if the U.S. makes it very, very clear, as Biden tried to do, that it's in their interest to work with on some sort of an arrangement on this. And it's part of the problem, to be honest, when it comes to the cyber stuff, is so much of it is classified and behind the scenes, and not to mention highly technical, that it's really hard to tell when there is actually progress or not, because oftentimes they just can't talk about it, especially in Washington. So it's one of those things that's going to be hard to monitor.
This summit was a far cry from the last one that happened between former President Trump and Helsinki. Putin, for his part, said that President Biden was a balanced professional man. He's clearly a very experienced politician. President Biden was fielding questions whether he could trust Vladimir Putin. He said, you know, it's not about trust. It's about our country's self-interest. You know, I told him what America needs out of our ongoing relationship.
Yeah, I mean, look, this is normal, you know, foreign policy is like every country has its own interests and you're trying to advance your country's interests. And so Biden has a very realistic point of view on that. And Putin said something similar about like, this is our national interest, that sort of thing. Although, you know, when it comes to Putin, people will argue it's his self-interest. He cares more about the Russian population as a whole. But, you know, the way Biden also kind of spun it, and I found this super interesting, was it was sort of like, wow, you know, nice country you got there. It would be a shame if anything happened to it, right? And but you know, but it was this way of doing it. He was like, look, I was telling Putin, like, wow, how would you feel if criminals attacked your energy pipelines, you know, or how, like, if you want to have more trade between Russia and other countries, maybe you shouldn't keep imprisoning American businessmen. You know, it was this whole idea of like kind of help me help you. But, you know, you could also see it as a veiled threat. So,
right, exactly.
So that was kind of how Biden tried to spin it. And, you know, I mean, Putin's an old hand at this stuff, and it's hard to say if he fell for that, you know, but if Biden does through sanctions, other means, if he feels like talks aren't going to work, if he uses these other things and really, really imposes a cost on Putin and his and the people around him, the oligarchs in particular, then it could start to hurt and Putin could start to make some moves.
There was a tense moment during his press conference. They had solo press conferences where he got a little combative with a reporter. He later on, before getting on the plane, he actually came back and said, sorry for being a wise guy and apologized for it, something we hadn't seen in a long time. So overall, how did he fare throughout this?
Well, you know, his assessment was, quote, I did what I needed to do. So he seemed quite confident in how he did. You know, it's never a good idea to get into a fight with the White House press corps, even if the question being asked is really, really frustrating to you. Biden, you know, the reporter asked, why are you so confident that Putin will change his behavior? And Biden was kind of like exasperated. He was like, I never said that. And he didn't ever say that. He never said he thinks Putin's going to do anything. So he was just kind of frustrated, I think, at the end and got into that. Then he did apologize, which you're right. We haven't seen that in a long time, given the Trump years. But overall, again, he seemed quite happy in how he did. But let's not forget, they set the bar pretty low on this. They warned us in advance, don't expect any major agreements, whatever. And they met that very low bar.
Nahal Tusi, foreign affairs correspondent at Politico, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This week, we also saw a new study done by the National Institutes of Health showing that in 5 states, some people were infected with COVID-19 before those states officially recorded their first cases. Blood samples collected between January and March of 2020 were tested for antibodies. Out of 24,000 samples, 9 came back positive. And while these cases were earlier than previously recorded, it doesn't show that there was much community spread at the time. For more on this, we'll speak to Betsy McKay, senior writer at the Wall Street Journal.
So the NIH has a big research program that you and the listeners may have heard of called the All of Us Research Program. And its goal is to enroll 1 million people across the country of diverse backgrounds. And through the database that they built in that, to study risk factors for disease and treatments and so forth. They're building this big database of blood samples and so forth from people, volunteers who enroll. So what they decided to do is use the blood samples that they have collected so far to look at this kind of growing question of interest. You know, how early did the pandemic reach U.S. shores? When did people first start getting sick? Because we know the first person to be, you know, formally diagnosed was in late January, around January 19th. But that was right after a test became available. So the CDC, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, develops a test. It's made, you know, available in its lab, and boom, 2 days later, someone has this. So that raises the question of, well, are they really the first person or not? So these researchers went through and tested blood samples going back to the beginning of January.
Out of 24,000, a little over 24,000 participants, they found evidence of infection in just 9 people. That suggests a number of different things. What they did find, though, also is that in 5 states, Illinois, Massachusetts, Mississippi, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, they had people that showed evidence of infection. And that was all before, you know, anybody had gotten in those first states. Big areas like California and New York, there were no infections that turned up, at least in these blood samples.
What they found was that people, you know, they looked at blood samples going back into early January. And what they were looking for were antibodies in the blood. These are blood samples that were taken at the time, and then they're frozen and stored for research later. So the researchers go back, they test the blood for antibodies using 2 different tests to make sure that it really is the COVID-19 virus called SARS-CoV-2 and not something else. So they found, you know, one person on January 7th, one person on January 8th, and that the antibodies they found normally start to appear about 2 weeks after someone is infected. So that means those 2 people, one in Illinois and one in Massachusetts, were likely infected around December 24th or maybe a little bit earlier. Then they went later in time through March, and, you know, 24,000 samples, as you said, they only found 9 cases. So what that shows is that certainly the virus was here earlier than we knew before, and a couple of studies have shown that now. But it wasn't, you know, not in large numbers. I mean, these were kind of like sporadic cases, and that happens often with infectious diseases. You know, something that causes an outbreak. There's a few cases here, a case there, and then eventually something takes hold and it starts to spread.
Right.
But until then, there are these cases that are missed.
One of the limitations in this study, and something that they wanted to look back into a little bit more, was that they don't really show travel history for these people, these 9 people that did have those infections. So I think they wanted to dig in a little bit more to see if they had traveled to China or contact with anybody from there around that time also.
There's very little actually known about these people and how they might have gotten infected. What this means is, looking back to that period, if you had some symptoms, the chances are that no, you didn't have COVID, but these aren't the only 9 people, right? I mean, they may
exactly.
have spread it to 1 or 2 other people. There are other people who may have had this and, you know, weren't involved in this study, but it wasn't in such large numbers that it would have been noticed, you know, that a hospital would have started noticing they were getting a lot of patients with the same strange symptoms. Sorry. So it just wasn't big enough at the time.
Yeah. And so we got this new data that I know you mentioned in the article. There was another study that had similar results in just showing that obviously we didn't have the COVID test ready to go when we started seeing the first inklings of it. So it was kind of expected that we were going to see some of these other infections floating around earlier than some of these first confirmed cases.
When the test first became available in January, because there weren't a lot of tests and there weren't a lot of labs that could do it, and then later, because there was a problem with the test, the public health authorities focused testing on people who had been to China or another country where there was COVID-19 spreading. So you and others may remember this. People who, you know, in February of 2020 thought they had COVID-like symptoms, but they hadn't traveled anywhere and they, you know, hadn't had contact with anyone who was known to have COVID-19, literally couldn't get a test. Now what we know is there were other people. You didn't have to travel to China, and there were people who weren't terribly ill. So the point, or one of the points here, is that is the importance of having a test that's widely available and not restricting your criteria for the test. That anybody with symptoms or who may have had contact should be able to get a test rather than limiting it to somebody who was in a place where the disease was spreading.
Betsy McKay, senior writer at the Wall Street Journal, thank you very much for joining us.
It's good to be with you. Thank you.
There's a lot happening these days, but I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. Oracle.com/strategic.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/news. That's LifeLock.com/news to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Even as more parts of the country continue to fully reopen from the pandemic, you're still going to see what many are calling hygiene theater. Think plexiglass dividers, scanning QR codes for menus, and the constant cleaning of surfaces, despite surface contact not being a significant transmitter of the virus. These actions have much more to do with making customers feel better than it does with science. For more on how long hygiene theater may last, we'll speak to Mark Fisher, senior editor at The Washington Post.
What we're seeing is that in some places we are moving back toward normal. In other places, businesses, public facilities, entertainment venues, all kinds of places like that are kind of caught in the middle because on the one hand, they want to open up. They want to give people a feeling of normalcy. On the other hand, they know that some of their customers are still very nervous about going out. They don't want to think they won't be safe. And so a lot of adopting precautions that really aren't scientifically merited. So you talked about things that bars against touching things, you know, this sort of heavy disinfecting of surfaces that we saw in the early months of the lockdown. There are transit systems and theaters and other public facilities that are still doing that, even though they know that the virus is not transmitted by touch. So why are they still doing it? Well, there are two big reasons. One is they're doing it to make their customers feel more comfortable. And the other is they're doing it to save money. They're doing some of these things to save money. So they're, for example, at restaurants, it's hard at some restaurants to get a printed menu anymore. You have to aim your camera and on the phone and pull up the QR code and pull up a digital menu. Well, that was initially done to make people feel more comfortable and to stop the spread. But now that's no longer valid scientifically. It's often being done to save money.
Right. And the question comes now, what will stick? What's going to stay with us after things fully reopen? And you were talking to some people about all of this. And one of the big pushes for getting vaccinated was everything is going to go back to normal, right? But with these things persisting, it tends to degrade that customer experience. You know, you can't move around as freely as you wanted to before. You still have plexiglass up and everything. So I kind of agree in that sense that it's still all these barriers are kind of off-putting. But a lot of it, as you mentioned, has to do with psychology. It makes customers feel more comfortable.
It puts business owners in a really tough spot because on the one hand, they don't want to alienate their customers who just want to feel more comfortable, feel safer. And so they want to keep up some of those precautions to communicate the sense that the business is taking this very seriously. I talked to some business owners who said, well, we're keeping the temperature checks because it gives people that feeling of comfort. I think eventually much of this goes away, but there's a really cautionary tale in the aftermath of 9/11. And if you think about all the things that have become a permanent part of the landscape, from showing an ID card in the lobby of an office building to some of the restrictions at airports, a lot of these precautions, once they're put in place, it's awfully hard to take them away.
You mentioned in the article, too, that a lot of Americans that want this kind of clear rules about how things are going to go forward, but there'll probably be a little more disappointment in the coming months as the reopenings are so uneven. Everybody's kind of all over the place. And, you know, obviously businesses for themselves, they don't want to get caught in something and you know, an outbreak happened and then they're held liable. So there's going to be a lot of this kind of one rule set, maybe taking it back, this jockeying back and forth is going to happen for a few months at least.
I think that's right. And probably at least through next winter, we're going to see the same kind of back and forth that we just saw, for example, from Southwest Airlines, where first they said they were going to resume serving alcohol on their flights. And then just days later, they scrapped that plan because they saw how poorly some passengers were behaving in the air these days. So there's going to be a back and forth. We're seeing it in hotels. We're seeing it in transit systems. And I think one of the main places we'll be seeing it is in entertainment venues, in bars and restaurants, in concert halls, movie theaters. They really are caught. They don't know exactly what they can safely let go of. And yet I hear from a lot of people that they're just ticked off by some of these restrictions. For example, at Nationals Park, the baseball stadium here in D.C., they put in these touchless dispensers for the condiments, replacing the old bins where you could kind of reach in and get a spoonful of onions to put on your hot dog. They replaced that with these machines that put down a huge plop of ketchup or mustard when you waved your hand under it. And fans went crazy. They said they didn't know how to operate it, and it was ruining their hot dogs because there was too much stuff coming out of the machine. And so finally the team said, okay, forget it. We won't do the touchless thing anymore. So there's going to be a lot of back and forth.
You know, it's up to, in all of these cases, it's our local public health experts who are making these decisions. Without some type of big national rule or something, it really is going to be down to being done at the local level.
And even at the individual business level. I talked to some folks from the National Restaurant Association, and they're telling their members, hey, you can go back to printed menus. You don't have to do the temperature checks. And yet many of their members are deciding to kind of violate that recommendation and go ahead and continue to have those restrictions, in part sometimes because they don't have the staff that they had before the pandemic. And so they don't have somebody who can rewrite the menus and print them out, and they don't want to pay for that. So it's going to be a mix of motives here, where it's not just about safety. It's not just about curbing the spread of the virus. It's also about what these individual businesses that have been hit so hard can afford going forward.
Mark Fisher, senior editor at The Washington Post, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Don't forget to join us on social media at Daily Dive Pod on Twitter and Daily Dive Podcast on Facebook. Leave us a comment, give us a rating, and tell us the stories that you're interested in. Follow us on iHeartRadio or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Oscar Ramirez, and this is the Daily Dive Weekend Edition.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350 plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s. Dance away with hip-hop beats and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com. or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
Nobody wants to outlive their money, but it happens, especially for women. That's why Gainbridge offers the Parity Flex annuity, designed for women's unique retirement needs, with flexible withdrawals plus a guaranteed lifetime income benefit that keeps paying you even if your account balance is zero. Gainbridge is helping build a better financial future for women. Retirement income you can't outlive is the ultimate flex. Start saving now at Gainbridge.io. Visit Gainbridge.io/ParityFlex for current rates, full product disclosures and disclaimers, and other important information.